Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guests today are Patricia Lorsin and Todd Shepherd, the editors of the volume French Mediterraneans, Transnational and Imperial Histories. And the book was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2016. Hi there, Patricia and Todd.
Hi.
Hello.
I just want to thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, what a
pleasure.
It's a pleasure, yes.
Why don't we begin by getting a little bit of background from both of you? So, Patricia, how did you come to work on France and its empire?
Well, when I was at Columbia University and I took a course with the late Graham Irwin, who suggested that I should write a paper on the Bureau Arabe because I had no idea what to write about in Africa. And I was so intrigued by what I read, and I came across all this literature about the Kabyles, and there was nothing in English about them at the time, so that got me going on Africa and really North Africa. I also grew up in the Middle East and North Africa, so It was a double sort of whammy, so to speak. I was very interested to pursue that.
And Todd?
So I kind of decided to come to French history for bizarre reasons. The way I came to it was through a paper that I did with Louise Tilly and Eric Hobsbawm at the New School at the time. It was a course on revolutions, and I kind of ended up doing a paper on, was the Algerian Revolution a French Revolution? And it was at the time a tactic to get into a history program and get a PhD fellowship and then skip over to American history. And then I realized that this topic was really compelling. And that it would also allow me to go to France to do research rather than travel the United States. So that was the premise. And then as I began to think about it in my first year at Rutgers University, where I ended up working with amazing people, you among them, I would say, but also my advisors, Bonnie Smith and eventually Joan Scott and others, the question of, you know, how does decolonization affect the former colonial powers seemed to be really important, kind of shaped by post-colonial theory and other discussions. And this was in the early 90s when I began. So that was really, I mean, the French-Algerian question was what led me to French history and even history as a discipline, I would say.
That's, I mean, Todd and I have known each other for a really long time, but I didn't know that story. I just want to ask you now both about the genesis of this collection. How did the two of you come to work together and specifically on this project? Patricia, do you want to start us?
Yes. At the University of Minnesota, we have a French Mediterranean collaborative. And every year we have either a workshop or a conference. And in 2011, we had one on Mediterranean identity. And there were a lot of people that attended, a lot of scholars from all over the States and elsewhere. But the percentage of modernists was very small. And one of the aims of this workshop or this conference was to produce books as a result of the people that participated. So Todd was a participator, and you know, there were only three other people. And so I asked Todd if he'd like to co-edit with me and get other people involved so that we could produce a book on sort of more modern period of the Mediterranean and some aspect of the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And as it was identities, rather than choose the type of French identities in the Mediterranean, which seemed rather pedestrian, we settled on French Mediterranean. And one of the themes, or many of the themes that the workshops over the years have dealt with, are migration in addition to identities. This year we're doing violence. So it really arose out of that workshop.
Todd, maybe you could say a little bit about the experience of the workshop, what you recall from 2011, it sounds like it was.
Well, yes, but I think this is very accurate. I mean, I was excited to be invited, in particular by Patricia. I mean, Patricia's work, of course, Imperial Identities, was such a foundational text for any of us thinking about France, French history in the 1990s, and that, I mean, thinking at that period about the past. And then Patricia, in particular, had invited me to what had also been an absolutely crucial conference for me previously, at Texas Tech, that also resulted in a super volume. It was like the first conference I went to when I just started at the University of Oklahoma. So I was excited to see Patricia in her new home. It was not that new at the time, but still new to me, in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And it was such a great group of scholars that were there. And I have also just a really clear memory of Patricia, you know, suggesting we go out to this, what turned out to be a really great diner, and presenting this possibility. And again, one of the things that I want to just reiterate that Patricia had said is how we both, I mean, obviously her first book and my first book, which was heavily, like much of the, you know, work that mattered to a lot of people in the, that appeared in the 1990s or a little after, was so focused on questions of identity, that we were both excited to kind of think about something different. And so the way that, and I'm quite sure it was Patricia who suggested this, the French Mediterranean's framing, you know, immediately proved, I think, really generative to both of us as we began to talk about possibilities, and then really seemed to capture a lot of great work. And again, to point out something that, again, Patricia already said, part of what was exciting about the conference or the workshop that I was involved in was this discussion with people working in all different chronological periods, as well as an aspect that we really foregrounded, people coming at this from all different geographical training, and to be able to think this Mediterranean question or frame within, in the context of the late modern period, the 19th and 20th century, was immediately seemed compelling.
I just want to ask you both some logistical questions. So you have a workshop. How did you get from the workshop to the group of scholars who are collected in this volume?
Well, nearly all the scholars were not involved in the conference. I mean, I'm a co-convener of this collaborative, but there's a medievalist, an early modernist, and me as the sort of modernist. And the vast majority of the people that were attracted to this to begin with were either early modern or medieval. So right. I felt it really important to get much more focus on the modern period.
Mm-hmm. So did you issue a call for contributors? And then I'm just wondering a bit about the putting together of a collection, I guess.
Well, I have a very good colleague here, Giancarlo Casale, and he suggested the Ottomanists. And so we approached them, and they were very keen. And then there were just, between Todd and I, we thought up a few of the other people that, you know, scholars whose work we knew, and invited them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was very much it. I mean, we immediately, I think, each had certain people that seemed obvious to us that are in the collection. You know, I'm thinking about Julia Clancy Smith. I'm thinking about Mary Dewhurst Lewis. I had just kind of worked with Andrew Arsan. I think we were both, you know, obviously one of the people that for French historians matters in this moment is Ian Culler's work. So, you know, Arab France. And then we just kind of began to reach out and to speak to other people. Sarah Stein was someone. Mm-hmm. And there were people that we wanted that couldn't participate, you know, that had other things to do.
Sure.
The framework that Patricia had suggested and that we both kind of immediately grabbed onto allowed us to think about it in interesting ways. And I think it was really lucky, but also increasingly something that we desired to kind of focus outside of people that we knew from within French history. So that was something that the kind of rolling effect of, you know, let's talk to this person and maybe they can suggest somebody and then, you know, find something. But it was also something that came from Patricia's, you know, deep involvement as co-convener, that she'd been really aware of all these different strands of discussions that are in other chronologically distinct areas of Mediterranean studies, so that the Ottoman period became obvious.
So one of the really interesting things that had arisen during the various workshops and collaboratives was the idea that the notion of the Mediterranean was as a sort of unit was essentially a Western one. And of course, this is something that's debated. A lot of historians of Islam and the Ottoman Empire don't see it like that. But this is why we invited the sort of Ottomanists, because I thought this was really interesting to see the way in which the Mediterranean was conceived in other historical areas other than France or Europe.
I just want to linger for a second on the plural of the title. The two of you describe the collection in the introduction as one that, and I'm quoting you here, reveals the significant French element in the 19th and 20th century making of a singular Mediterranean. So could we talk a little bit about this idea of pluralizing the Mediterranean and how that emblematizes the shift or the intervention that the collection is making?
Well, very often when one thinks of the French Mediterranean, one looks at it very much from the perspective of France and Algeria or France and the Maghreb. Mm. So I think what was important to us was to go beyond that. And as Todd mentioned, Ian Collar's work was very important in rethinking the whole periphery of the Mediterranean in terms of French influence or what had influenced France as well, not just how France had influenced other areas. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how we sort of came upon it.
Do you want to add to that, Todd?
A little bit, yeah. Just to you know, extend the discussion that you know, Patricia in the introduction did such a great job of mapping out for us this expansive discussion about the Mediterranean, kind of anchored in Brodel and Guitton, you know, more recently revised. But you know, one of the things that she was able to really make clear to me is how the idea of the Mediterranean as a geological entity was something that anchored these earlier discussions and the more recent revisions of them. You know, the Peregrine and such, they're, and now I'm forgetting the title of the Savage Sea or something. And how, one of the things that we're so foregrounding, of course, is the political, the political challenge that had inspired a lot of thinking about margins versus periphery, the need to think multiplicity, so that in the modern period, of course, this idea of a unitary Mediterranean was something that was so, you know, necessarily political and related to imperialism. I mean, I remember just, you know, we did, this is not something we put in the introduction, but when I was first starting my work, I mean, I remember talking to an early modernist just in reminding, he was reminding me of, hey, you know, Brodel theorized and wrote about the Mediterranean in the midst of what? In the midst of the Algerian War. You know, if you think about Anne Thompson's fundamental work on colonial enlightenment, one of the things that she made clear, you know, decades ago and that other people have, and I'm thinking of Gillian Weiss, for example, have made clear more recently is how the idea that the Mediterranean was connected was something that was widely perceived in Europe and in France in the late 18th century. And then the idea that it's wholly a point of division is this anchor for what, you know, Edward Said would identify in the 19th century version as an Orientalism, but that also explicitly, as Gillian Weiss and others have shown, you know, sets the stage for the invasion of Algeria as something wholly foreign. So this break and the idea of unity and break was something that had a real historical importance and showed its political. So all of these things were things that we wanted to grapple with by pointing to the French Mediterraneans as multiple, even as, you know, in terms of French historians, we really wanted to, as Patricia highlighted, to make clear that the Mediterraneans and this multiplicity were shaping France, were part of France, also helped us break up what Frenchness was, what a thinking about identity might limit us to, that there's something coherent about France, even if we're challenging that, that the Mediterraneans, and the ways that any of these different versions could be in some ways French was something that was really exciting to us. And again, one of the things that you see in the collection is different people using, some people are using the French language, that there are French people, some people identify with France. There's all sorts of different ways that Frenchness mattered to So both of these things, dividing up the plurality of what histories of Frenchness or French, the French or French something could mean, as well as insisting on the Mediterranean's, it matters. And it's always back and forth between, is it two, is it one? Multiple reminds us that there's more things going on.
You also describe the collection as one that repositions modern French history as transnational and imperial history, one that responds to and contributes to the what we might call the colonial and transnational turns. So I guess I want to ask you both about this. One of the things you point to in the introduction is that prior to this collection and some other more recent work, that people working on empires from Europe have had a tendency to ignore existing work or neglect existing work of those in the peripheries, other types of habits. So in terms of the interventions that you see the collection making in the fields or in terms of the methodologies of transnational and imperial history, I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Patricia?
Well, I think the articles that deal with the Ottoman and or the or sort of Middle East and the non-French territories and non-French colonial territories, I think are very important in bringing that out, bringing that dimension out. Mm. What do you think, Todd?
Well, I think that as the title suggests and as our original discussion suggests, you know, 2011, 2012, I mean, obviously transnational had been a big theme since the late 1990s, early 2000s. But it increasingly also seemed like maybe an alternative to the colonial, to the imperial, that if the imperial turn had kind of reached a, not a, if not an imp, had done its work, let's look elsewhere. And so one of the things I think we were is working on this project really pointed out to us is that, of course, we want to think about the transnational. Everything is not reducible to the colonial. And in particular, by not thinking about just the colonial, it does allow for, you know, as Patricia just emphasized, things coming from the Ottoman world, things coming from Morocco, from Jewish discussions between Morocco and what became Algeria, you know, that those things matter. But at the same time, we want to hold, you know, as the introduction also makes clear, I mean, the 19th and 20th centuries, those that we cover, you know, are deeply, deeply shaped by Western imperialism writ large. You know, Spencer Segala's piece really brings in U.S. imperialism, for example, and certainly French imperialism. So the risk of transnational alighting the imperial was one thing I thought we wanted to do. But at the same time, you know, really push this discomfort or this critique that people from other fields were suggesting of, you know, the transnational, particularly from a U.S., maybe not a North American, but a U.S. kind of point of view, tended to be Americanist, kind of, we're going to do transnational history and just exporting themes outward into the rest of the world, into the Caribbean, into Europe, et cetera, without really grappling with the historiographies, the discussions, the work that had been done by people there or people who were experts there. So that was another, you know, big concern. And as Patricia said, I think having so many people, a majority of contributors who came from without France and without Europe, I mean, from outside of European histories, was really helpful in that.
I think another important thing is that very often when one sees a transnational history, in fact, only about two or maybe three countries are involved. And I think that one of the really refreshing things about studying the Mediterranean is that there are so many different, I won't even say nations, but sort of ethnic groups and cultural and social backgrounds that create a really rich historiography. Mm-hmm. So I think this was really one of the important things, was to show that it wasn't, you know, French transnationalism wasn't just across the Mediterranean, but it was encompassing all the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, it was unfortunate, really, that we weren't able to get, say, an Italian historian who also could have contributed. But of course, I mean, we had 12, and, you know, there's just so much you can take in. But perhaps the second volume.
I want to ask a little bit about some of the other things that are specifically not in the volume, and the decisions around not covering certain material or issues that have maybe been covered elsewhere or that are different from the project that you were both interested in. You note that this is not a collection about how non-French or colonized people refashioned France, that it's not reaching out from France and back in that way. And you also note that this is not a collection that deals specifically with the question of French Orientalism or with the Berber question. So I just wanted to ask about those things and other things that you may have, you know, made the decision to not cover in this volume.
Maybe I could speak to that first. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the introduction does obfuscate what a couple of, certainly some of the articles, and I'm thinking about, for example, Ian Culler, Ali Yesiloglu really contribute directly to discussions of how France is framed and redefined from outside of France. Also in the more recent period, I think that, you know, Mary Lewis's work here is in the book, but also Spencer Segala's work. I mean, all does that work too. So I think one of the things we were trying to do in the introduction is to position what, you know, how we wanted people to enter into the book as a whole. So and I think different authors obviously were still participating in that. But it was a decision, again, we made it, we didn't want it to be about French identity. And therefore, since that frame was so weighted in it and so important to our own previous work, I think that was one thing we wanted to have people focus on, some of the other key themes that were there.
Mm-hmm. Patricia, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, some of these articles, particularly the LDEM article, and it just shows the sorts of areas that many historians just overlook, that actually are very important in creating the notion of the way in which France expanded and the way in which other countries responded to France. I was thinking of that, and I was also thinking of the coinage, the Ames.
Yes, Mark Ames, too.
Yeah, which is, again, I mean, it's fascinating if you think of these two articles that really deal with very localized, well, at least the Ed Eldem one deals with very sort of localized influences and yet were really important influences.
You mentioned, Patricia, the fact that you felt it was really important, well, that you both felt that it was really important to steer the conversation around Mediterraneans towards more of an emphasis on the modern period, that you had more early modern participants in the original workshop, and that part of the aim of this collection is to emphasize the modern period. So I just wanted to ask a little bit about some of the thematic and methodological differences between the approach of early modernists, and I know that calls for some generalizations, between the early modernists and the kinds of issues and thematics that become more salient in the work of historians dealing with the modern period.
Well, I mean, I think that in the early modern, certainly medieval period, of course, there are no nation states.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, religion plays a very important role. I think more and more people today are looking at the sort of gender dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, there's similarities. But migration and the way in which groups moved around, I think this is one of the things that the early modernists emphasize. So I think that that creates a different perspective.
Do you want to add to that, Todd?
Well, I think that, you know, the crucial historiographical dispute that is the introduction and Patricia really, you know, brings to the fore was the non-unity of the Mediterranean from non-European perspectives. Again, you know, I think most of us can think back to the historiography around the so-called the Crusades, you know, how for the so-called Islamic world, most historians would argue now that this was not a thing, right? It was one of many, many conflicts on the outskirts, on the margins of the caliphate, et cetera. That similarly, like the Mediterranean was one of the spaces, it was a frontier space, but one of many frontier spaces that was discussed and central to the Islamic world or Muslim thinkers, Muslim politics, et cetera. That's very different in the 19th century. So that kind of clearly that historiographical discussion is not applicable. In the 19th century, it's in the 20th century, the Mediterranean seems like a whole and a unity, and that unity has been, if anyone doesn't want it to be that way, European powers are enforcing it. I mean, again, we can think, as Patricia said earlier, think about Italy, and we can think about it in horrifying ways around the, you know, the invasion, the horrific massacres in Libya in the 19-teens and 20s when Italy started to invade Libya. Mm-hmm. So this insistence that this was part of, whether Agadir, et cetera, et cetera. French Algeria, clearly Egypt's protectorate status under the British, controlled by the British. So that discussion is really distinct. I mean, that this what has become a big historiographical debate among early modernists, I don't think is, and that's one of the things that the book really maps out. Our French Mediterraneans is explicitly challenging what was a politically enforced unity at the time, even as it's also drawing attention to the ways that claims about clear distinctions, you know, have chronological certainties and not simply geographical anchors. Mm-hmm. So from, you know, we talked about already the 18-teens, when Anne Thompson and now Gillian Weiss have both really pointed us to these insistent claims that the north and the south of the Mediterranean were wholly different and below was barbarism, and this needed to be conquered. Potentially, mm-hmm. and it was by the French. To them, we think of the 1960s and decolonization and how that, you know, inserts this division between North and South as something that may seem obvious. And again, you know, historiographically interesting because it's the very moment when people like Brodel or all these French politicians are trying to make the claim of unity. So that's one of the big differences, I think, that was really, really mattered to us in this period, in large part because of empire and imperialism, unity seems really clear. And then, as Patricia said before, questions of nation state are very different, but questions of migration are then shaped by these differences. The existence of nation, this is one of the things that I think Mary Lewis's article does so well, but the attention that we and others and the people in the volume paid to migration, you know, it can seem from a modernist perspective that these are simply possible because of imperialism. We know that's not true. There's a much longer history. And again, Julia Clancy Smith has been really crucial for those of us in French history to think about this, again, modern French history. But empire does give real shape to migrations in ways that it perhaps didn't before.
I think there's something that one needs to remember, that the Mediterranean has always been an imperial area, first with the Romans, of course, and then with the Ottomans. And so there's always been a kickback against those empires in some way or another. And of course, as we progress into the modern period, the time frame shrinks, so to speak. I mean, it becomes much easier because of communications and because of the way people can travel. The time frame becomes much shorter in the sort of conflicts between empire and non-empire, and the transmission of ideas and migrations. I think that's something that one needs to bear in mind.
I just want to follow up on, I guess, the broad question of the periodization of the collection that runs from the late 18th century to decolonization. And I mean, there's some apparently obvious things about that, you know, emphasizing the modern period. But to go to decolonization, I wonder if either one of you have thoughts on where the collection ends chronologically, and whether that was a choice that had to do with who came together or whether it was a conceptual decision as well.
Conceptually, it matters. And I think that, you know, we have these two amazing articles, or the Kubi article, which is introducing, you know, it became a kind of touchstone for what's going to be very soon, I'm quite sure, a new book. I think it'll come out next year. Mm-hmm. Spencer Segala's book on natural disasters is also one that's about to come out, that are really rethinking the decolonization period in really interesting ways. And part of what they're foregrounding is how these certainties of difference emerge, and then also immediately get caught up in questions of power and imperialism, you know, questions of whether it's the United States, whether it's forms of Western imaginaries, as Emma Kubi shows, around the Shoah and the Holocaust, and shaping how people were able to think about French camps that were, you know, in which they were shoving all these Algerians. So that made a lot of sense to us, I think. But at the same time, though, the work that we found was so dense in the 19th century, and we just got such great work that it made so much sense to kind of home in on that too. But the work that we received as well, and the stuff that we saw, I think really convinced us that it was worth thinking about this decolonization moment as not an endpoint, but a nice kind of a breakpoint chronologically and in terms of the coherence of the different pieces, something that begins in the late 18th century and takes a different shape, I think, perhaps, after the 1960s. But we, again, the second volume might include that discussion too.
Mm-hmm. Patricia?
I think one of the interesting things too is if, for example, one wanted to push the idea of the French Mediterranean after decolonization, we'd have to look much further than just the rim of the Mediterranean. Mm. I think we'd have to look to the sort of southern shores and beyond. And the one article that does sort of hint at that is the article about the Mazab, because that's much lower down. But the influences on the Mediterranean from sub-Saharan Africa were huge. And that's something that would be very interesting to consider, the sort of French influences. Because if you look today at the influence of France or the traces of France, much more specific in sub-Saharan Africa than in North Africa, I'd say, because of the strong Islamic culture in North Africa. Whereas if you look at French West Africa, the traces of France really lasted up until this present century. Mm-hmm. And it's only most recently that you're getting a sort of dilution. The other thing I should say is that although nobody realized it at the time, I think after the decolonization period, you have the serious rise of the American empire. And you know, whatever one might say is it's an empire that's not an empire, or the empire without any clothes, or however one wants to describe it, the fact is it is very much an empire. It's just an empire in a different form.
Todd, did you want to?
I mean, one of the things that we, you know, the Mediterranean studies and thinking about the Mediterranean obviously has been shaped by Atlantic world historiography. And one of the things that Atlantic world historians are finally beginning to grapple with explicitly is how centrally this was a Cold War historiography, right? I mean, that it was about anchoring the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, anchoring these different, and so here we might think of Turkey as the hinterlands. But this very moment that, I mean, part of this other project, if we think of Brodel and the fight to keep Algeria part of France, is a different vision of how the world could have been imagined. I mean, sort of in the 60s and 70s, part of what made the Mediterranean exciting to people was they seemed secondary, marginal. The world was really now anchored, as we were told, the history of civilization, the West, et cetera, was anchored in the Atlantic world. So I think that, you know, that periodization too is interesting. I mean, the historical period in which we stop, the volume in the 1960s, is also the historical period that the historiographical production that marginalizes the Mediterranean and thus makes thinking about its wholeness via Brodel and others in Guitton so interesting. And then from our perspective, it becomes easier to see how that was something that happened historiographically. And I think, again, from the Atlantic world historiography, questions of hinterlands, again, Sarah Stein's work as on Dreyfus in the Mazab in the Sahara, is where we really, there's an explicit grappling with that, but where we're trying to, we break really clearly from the Mediterranean as something that touches these different areas and help us think differently with it. But again, more work needs to be done.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I wanted to just ask a little bit more about the way that space runs throughout these essays, sometimes physical space, sometimes imaginary space, coast and interior, and of course, Sarah Stein's essay is making me think about that the most. I think there's another issue of microregions coming up. So yeah, how you think about these essays intervening with respect to questions of space?
Well, I think one of the important things that this volume contributes is it shows the very different types of space that are important in creating a notion of a French Mediterranean. Very often when you have histories, they're sort of focused on one particular type of space. But here I think what is important is that it's not only geographical, but it's also intellectual.
Well, very much. And one of the ways that we tried to signal that, of course, was, you know, that we are three sections of the book. And one of them is about maps, you know, or position in terms of maps. The second one is position in terms of frameworks, shifting frameworks of migration. And the third one in margins. So we wanted to really, you know, make explicit this idea that these Mediterraneans, these different ways of deploying, articulating, invoking French or France or what Frenchness is that different people, different authors are using in this project. They were both things that actors at the time were using, and they were analytic categories. And that back and forth, of course, is something that history as a discipline, you know, as an approach, is particularly committed to, constantly trying to think with actors' categories, historical, you know, avoid anachronism, and at the same time constantly needing to deploy frameworks, whether it's narrative frameworks or analytic frameworks or theoretical frameworks, to think that material and to make sense of it.
I wonder if either one or both of you has more to say about the structure of the volume in these three parts that Todd has conveniently allowed me to segue into. This first part of the book focused on rethinking Mediterranean maps, maps to rethink the Mediterranean. The second part, shifting frameworks of migration or migrations across the Mediterranean. And the third part of the volume, margins remade, in parentheses, by the Mediterranean. So it sounds like the question of space was really at work in thinking about these three parts, and especially the naming of these three parts and the conceptualization. Were there other things that you all were thinking about as you divided up these essays or thought about how to organize them and structure the volume? Patricia?
Well, I think the first thing, before we actually thought about the actual sections, we really wanted to think about who was contributing and what they were going to say. And it was as a result of having agreed to get these various articles together. And when we looked at the brief summaries that they provided and their titles, we started to put them into these different categories. But then once we actually read the articles, again, there were occasional shifts that we made. So I don't think, at least I can't remember, that we sort of thought these particular groups right at the beginning. I mean, we had the idea of breaking the volume up into different sections, but, you know, a lot of it depended on the authors and how they were going to, you know, what they were going to produce.
Todd?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm looking back at some of the earlier versions. We'd lined up things about revolutions, conflicts, politics and policies, migrations and displacements, Arab, Jews, Kabyles, when we had different, we had a different lineup at that point. So I think we had a different set of questions. And the idea of really foregrounding Mediterraneans, the multiplicity, by foregrounding this question of the frame, use for the utility of it, the Mediterranean, this Mediterranean, which Mediterranean, when, and how these this differ over time, differ for different historians, different scholars looking back, just as it differed for different actors when that are being studied, was the way that we kind of ended up putting forward to people to think through the different pieces, which means, you know, so we didn't wholly rely on chronology. Again, Edom's book, article, for example, is in the second section, even though chronologically it would have gone, you know, right with Ian Cullors, et cetera, Salugu's piece. So, but again, as Patricia said, like most historians, we kind of winnowed through the evidence that we had once we had the actual articles and began to draw the themes that were actually in there and then highlighted those we thought were most important to kind of foreground for everybody, but then organize them in ways that would make sense together.
Am I right that all of the authors in the collection are trained as or working as historians?
Yeah. But, I mean, not Europeanists.
No, not Europeanists, but I just mean in terms of, I guess I'm nudging towards a question about disciplinary methodological differences and unity and what it means to have a collection of historians, whether there were other possibilities or, the question of interdisciplinarity, either including or not including non-historians, but within the work that these historians are doing, whether, you know, they might all be historians, but working differently methodologically.
Yeah, I think that's really important because whether you're an Ottomanist or whether you're studying Jewish history or French history or North African history, there are different issues and different themes and concepts that are important at a particular moment. And I think that was really one of the things that I particularly found really interesting in these different historians, because their interests and the concepts that they used were not unique, obviously, but their preoccupations mirrored the sort of preoccupations of the moment at which they were writing. And I think that was I found a very interesting dimension of this book.
Todd?
No, I think both, you know, both Patricia and I in our work, you know, have been very, I'm thinking of Patricia's recent book, which really draws from literary theory and the work of literary critics, as well as, you know, deeply informed as a historian in historical work and archival work, et cetera. And I, too, have always been interested in these kind of interdisciplinary engagements. Mm-hmm. But with this project, you know, one of the things that was really important to us was to home in on, again, these big discussions, Mediterranean's imperial history, the imperial turn, the transnational histories, the transnational turn, and kind of bring them together to foreground some of the things that they hid from view, mm-hmm. some of the possibilities that they opened up. And one of those possibilities is to create dialogue. Again, one of the concerns is the imperialism of one discipline insisting that its approaches dominate all others, or historians based in North America who work on North American topics dominate, or historians who do, most importantly, European and North American histories dominate other discussions. So really to be able to draw those things together was really useful. And one of the things that we, one of the keystone or, you know, touchstones at the end of the introduction is the question of sources. That mm-hmm. is to say, there's something particular about the ways historians work that we do recognize in each other. You know, like Roxanne, I worked with Bonnie Smith, who's done amazing work on mm-hmm. helping us think about historical methodology, how the kind of methods, the acts that historians do rather than simply the ideals of objectivity or something. And the idea of primary source research is one of those. And so it was really exciting to us to bring together these historians trained in different national schools, but historians who also were focused on really different methodologies. Mm-hmm. And so Adam's work, Yossi Ilgla's work, really Ames's work. I mean, these are people that are just doing much, much different, like historical approaches with focused on different types of evidence than many of the discussions or the historiographical approaches that have dominated recent modern French history.
You emphasize historians and their use of different sources and archival material in the collection, and signal in particular the use of legal sources. I don't know if you'd call that a legal turn in this field, but do either one of you want to say more about that, Patricia?
Well, certainly more and more historians are looking at the legal aspect of imperialism, colonialism, and so yes, I think that is important.
Mm-hmm. But sort of legal pluralism, you know, for historians of empire, from I think Lauren Benton is one of the touchstones here. Her work, but many other scholars have been using that. Again, Lewis and Stein each really delve into that here. Forum shopping, you know, these have been big discussions. There's also another strand of that turn to the legal, kind of in some ways post-Foucaultian approaches, you know, using Foucaultian analyses or at least frames, but focused on evidence that was not, it was explicitly excluded by Michel Foucault in his own kind of philosophical historical work. So the law, those types of institutions. So it's been a useful, it's been useful for different scholars, different historians in particular, in different ways in the last couple of decades, I think. And so we were trying to bring together different scholars who do different, different historians who do different things with the legal.
Speaking of difference, I have kind of a grab bag question. I hate to pull all these things into one place, but I will, about the ways that the different essays, and you can feel free, both of you, to reference whichever essays come to mind, engage questions of religious difference, ethnic or racial difference, economic class differences, gender.
Well, I have to say, I didn't actually think about that at the outset, but of course, this is an underlying theme that's very important in any history of empire or connections between two different areas. Mm-hmm. And the whole role of religion in the Mediterranean has been so vital across the ages. I mean, it's not anything new today, as has ethnicity. I mean, the whole, particularly for the French, this notion of culture and cultural difference. So I do think that some of these articles bring that out, mm-hmm. particularly the article in the Margins Remade, I think, are important in showing the sort of ways in which different religious or ethnic or cultural ideas or frameworks oscillate together or complement each other or repel each other. Mm-hmm. I think all the articles touch on it in some way or another. You can't consider the Mediterranean without considering all these differences and the way in which they work together or against each other.
Todd?
And I think, I mean, so from the first couple essays, Yesioglu and Collar's essay, both of them are using, I mean, Yesioglu actually more explicitly, the concept of East of Enlightenment that Ian Collar had discussed to really extend their idea of the Age of Enlightenment is one that included Muslim lands, Muslim actors, people explicitly thinking with Enlightenment, Republic of Letters, discussions, sources, forms of the new forms of deploying evidence to kind of comment on society and make claims in a Muslim context in reference to Islam, as well as in reference to European discussions writ large or Mediterranean discussions writ large. But then we also see more particular, that is something that doesn't have to be subsumed or, you know, is not simply part of a larger European history. I think the work that, you know, Susan Miller's tracing out in the case of Moïse Naon, both the persistence of Jewish networks that cross the Moroccan-Algerian frontier that kind of work within. However, increasingly, this is what, you know, Susan so effectively shows, I think, among other things, is how this Jewish set of thinkers, that of which Naon is an exceptional example, really takes advantage of new possibilities that are made available through the extension of French Empire to create new connections that still are feeding back into contributing to intra-Jewish discussions that are still at this point deeply embedded in Jewish-Muslim discussions. So there's that. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, like one of Mary Lewis's great work here in thinking about the disappearance or the kind of challenge to forum shopping, to get back to the legal, is how the French in their establishment or their affirmation of their unique protectorate status over Tunisia want to break down the possibilities for Europeans to take advantage of their particular, that is Italians or Poles or Brits, to take advantage of particular legal arrangements between their so-called home country and Tunisia, and get subsumed into French, that is all the so-called Christians are all under one. How difficult it is to push then all the Muslims, notably the Algerian Muslims, to try to play on the French, their French status, their nationality, even as they're being pushed to kind of align with Tunisians, but then can be an advantage for Libyans, people living in what becomes Libya, who can play on this status. So that, again, the breaking down that, unlike what Collar, Yesioglu, and Miller have shown, and other people are showing in the collection, you know, trying to assert that there's a real distinction between Islam and the Christian world. And again, the Jewish historians with Sarah Stein's work on the How the Dreyfus Affair works very differently to break and try to break Jews off of that, you know, complicate this. But that's really interesting. I think it's one of the really interesting stories is how this is a space of great exchange, of intersections, where the particularity of religious groupings and discussions is real, but the interconnections between literally the three big religions is also really, really present, and how hard people are working to divide them up.
You've both hinted at another volume. Is that in the works or a plan?
Well, it might be. It might be after this interview. But, I mean, no, it's not in the works.
Okay, so at a couple of moments, the ideas for what could be in that next step have come up, and I just wonder whether or not I'm not going to make you commit to doing a second volume during this interview, but if you could imagine where this project or field or set of questions needs to go next, whether or not you're both responsible for that, where do you see things going?
Well, I think some of these issues that have been raised in this particular volume have been developed. Pascal Fugès, for example, has just written a book on the revolution in the Ottoman world, and it's a diplomatic history, so it's an interesting difference because he also traces the results during the French Republic and the way in which French nationals in the Levant reacted. So I think that one wouldn't want to just sort of make a second volume as a chronological extension, but would want to redevelop or approfondir, as they say, some of these themes in another volume. But I don't actually see that happening right away.
Todd?
I mean, I think that there's been some great responses already. And so two of them, I think, you know, Joshua Schreier did a great review, or, you know, a really generous review in Journal of Modern History that I think really opened up some possibilities for thinking, but also Patrick Bouchon. So let's reference our French colleagues. And Patrick Bouchon, of course, at the Collège de France now, and his Histoire mondiale de la France, which inspired such enormous controversy, public, historiographical to a certain extent too, but certainly public in France. You know, and in a recent piece that he co-published, he explicitly cited our, you know, book along with other American discussions as ones that should really be models for the ways that French historians should think and that they're trying to think too. So I think that this, you know, one of the things that was exciting about the volume was bringing in different historiographical discussions. I mean, Mark Ames, who is a French scholar based in France, but is an Ottomanist, you know, was one of these people. And I think both Patricia and I have had this experience of, you know, people in France from other disciplines besides history, or certainly other national histories besides French national history, who are French and trained in France, are people that have been excited by our work and taken it up in ways that are, you know, notable. But I think that the discussion among French historians is also shifting. So that would be one, you know, potential way to go. That's really and I think one tendency that's happening that's really promising is that not only, again, in the United States discussion, the North American discussion, the continued importance of the transnational, but also still the imperial turn as framing how people do so-called French history is ongoing. You know, so there, I mean, I think the French Mediterranean's frame is one. There's continued work on French Atlantic, again, in the early modern period, most particularly into the late 18th, notably, that might be something. But I think we're going to continue to see a lot of these discussions. I mean, here for, you know, some we might say professional reasons, I mean, to get hired in this country, for many people, it seems necessary to engage with histories outside of France or that place France or French topics into much broader frameworks. But that's also an intellectual concern. And that's, I think, we're refreshingly seeing from recent discussions among French historians in France itself. So I think all of these, you know, offer a lot of possibilities for people to take up some of the frames that we've pointed to. Hopefully the Mediterranean and French Mediterraneans will prove useful. And I think it seems to be.
So usually at the end of these interviews, I ask a single author or a single editor what they are working on now or next. So I want to do that, whether it's because our listeners need to know or just selfishly, I want to know, Patricia, what are you working on?
Well, I have two interests. The actual monograph I'm thinking about is about the Cold War art and politics and the way in which art and politics come together in transnational activism. And this also concerns the United States. It's a sort of triangular United States, France, and Algeria. But instead of looking at sort of a diplomatic dimension, it's looking at the art and politics and the way in which art is politicized or not. And I'm looking at the American communities in Paris and the way in which they responded to the Algerian War. And that's not just the African-American, but also American artists that were there. That's the sort of monograph. The other thing I'm very interested in, and I'm trying to sort of get going in a sort of conference way, is nostalgia. Because I feel very strongly that nostalgia has been marginalized as a sort of wistful dimension of memory. And in fact, there are more historians, and of course Svetlana Boyum was the first that sort of pushed it in this direction, but it's really become a very important political tool. And I think for that reason, and for sociological reasons, I don't think it should be marginalized by historians in the way it has done. I think Mayer was the one that said that nostalgia to memory is what kitsch is to art. And I don't agree with that at all. So that's my mission.
Well, that sounds very exciting.
The other is my monograph.
Right. Well, Todd, I know you've just published a book, and we're going to get to talk about it soon.
Great book, I should say.
Yes, a great book.
Sex, France, and Arab Men, 1962 to 1979, from the University of Chicago.
Very, very attractive, very engaging title.
Yes. So, but what's going on now, Todd, or next?
Well, I think one thing I did want to note is that, you know, in the book, we displaced Algeria and French Algeria from the center of it. Most of the scholars working here are not working on Algerian topics. I mean, Sarah Stein and Emma Kubi both really home in on Algeria. And again, mm-hmm. both of them put it in the context of their larger work, which is not Algerian-centric. But like Patricia, I'm continuing to work primarily in the immediate on a French-Algerian topic. So again, about social welfare policy during the Algerian Revolution, French efforts to use the claim that there was an Algerian problem that France confronted, but it wasn't colonialism, since France was not a colonial power. Algeria was part of France, but it was French racism towards so-called Muslims. And so the ways that they came up with this policy, I talk about it a little in The Invention of Decolonization, my first book, but I really delved into that both in the FLN archives, which I had access to in Algiers, the Bir Kadim, around the ways that the FLN both collected all sorts of information and kind of came up with all sorts of ways to respond to what the French called integrationism. Mm-hmm. So this policy that the French claimed broke with both assimilationism and associationism was something wholly new that most historians kind of dismiss. And so my project really takes this seriously, in part following on what GPRA, the Provisional Government of the Algerian Republic's analysts and kind of leaders thought. This was some really interesting stuff. Also, again, drawing from the transnational, from UNESCO sources in particular, how the French drew these from kind of sociological and anthropological discussions in the post-war period. Notably, they kind of referenced Mexican models from the 1930s. So again, trying to trace out some of the ways that the French really at this point used Republican arguments, but to make claims about the possibility of identifying and recognizing racism. Mm-hmm. At fighting French racism as a real problem, that they did so, it turns out, through the adoption of really strict quota policies with explicit definitions of who was a French Muslim citizen from Algeria, which was based on not Islam, but based on origins, and that they did so through an analysis drawn from primarily American sociologists who argued that, you know, discrimination was the key category in which states could address racism. And that it could be done, therefore, by discrimination could be defined by measuring the effects and not focusing on causes. So it's really interesting in the French Republican story that we know so well. You know, I'm thinking of Frater and Herrick Chapman's great Introduction to Race in France, of this idea that even to talk about racism is racist. You know, here again, we've seen this recently with let's expunge the word race from the French Constitution. Here, the idea was, since you're focusing on the effects, you don't have to challenge the fact that the French Republican administrators and loyal lawmakers wanted to be anti-racist. You could focus on the facts, the measurable facts, at least, that they had been racist and their effects. So it's an interesting policy that particularly kind of disappeared from memory, that also directly shapes the ways that French social policy works today. It's the kind of French version of social citizenship that we know a lot about in the British case, et cetera, but that in this post-war effort to break away from class-based analyses and particularly to break away from a language of rights, to talk about groups in need that the government could help, solidarity, et cetera. Sung-Yun Choi, Amelia Lyons have both done really interesting work in this field. So that's the project that I'm hoping to finish soon. I've done tons of research and I'm hoping to move forward with that. And I published a bunch. But then another piece that I published in IJMES a few years ago on what happens to French laïcité discussions. Again, laïcité, but hopefully maybe not wholly Algerian-centric, in the 60s and 70s and 80s when no one really was talking about this. I mean, remember, this is the period, the Fifth French Republic, let's remind everyone, you know, funds Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. There's this whole period when people think laïcité just is not a problem, and it's causes great despair among people who really are for laïcité. It causes great despair among people who want France to be Catholic. But it kind of imposes itself as an evidence in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it's one of those things that, again, the 80s marks a real break with that, whether it's the return to power or the coming to power of the Socialist Party, the Savary laws and their efforts to end funding private schools, or, of course, the Veil Affair within the background, of course, a much larger story of the crisis of state socialism, the collapse of the Soviet model, the crisis of the left, of Marxism, et cetera. So that's another project that I'm trying to work on.
Well, that all sounds like very exciting work, and I hope you'll both keep me posted. I just want to thank you both so much for speaking with me about this volume and for putting it together.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Roxanne. It's a great podcast, and these were great questions and great discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.